All right, now, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. You're here once again with the captain of the mothership, Lawrence Brown. So happy to be here with you. I'm so excited about our next guest. I'm such a fan of Elizabeth Evatt Dickinson's work, and I'm glad that she's here in the studio. Elizabeth has written about architecture, design, and urbanism for a national publication for nearly 20 years. Her articles and essays have been published in the New York Times, the New York Times Magazine, and the Atlantic Magazine City Lab, among many others. And she's a contributing editor with Architect Magazine, teaches writing at MICA, and was the former editor of Urbanite Magazine in Baltimore. Elizabeth, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. You know, we just finished talking about, you know, the trauma that was the transatlantic slave trade. And I sort of wanted to narrow the focus and bring it to Baltimore and understand segregation and what that means for this city. You wrote an article about Roland Park and how it was at one time whites only. Can you tell us a little bit about what you and the doctoral student, from what I understand, uncovered in certain archives at Johns Hopkins University?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really fascinating story. So last year, an editor at Johns Hopkins Magazine approached me about a new archive that had just gone public at the Sheridan Libraries at Hopkins. And this archive effectively is all of the papers from something called the Roland Park Company. Mm. And the Roland Park Company was incorporated in 1891 in Baltimore to develop what is now known as Roland Park. Mm-hmm. But they would also go on to develop a lot of other neighborhoods in Baltimore, including Guilford and Homeland and Dundalk and others. And they, they were around until the 1960s. And when they closed in 1960, all of the papers, like every document that they ever kept, mm-hmm. were packed up, sent to Cornell University, mm-hmm. and archived in a library there. And a couple of scholars over the years have accessed those papers. But in 2010, Hopkins got those back. They thought it was important to have this archive in Baltimore.
Right.
And the reason is this archive really illuminates mm-hmm. the early history, the sort of taproots of real estate policy in America, and how bigotry played a really big role in what would become federal national housing policy in the way we think about real
estate. Absolutely. I mean, this is astonishing, the level of granularity we're able to get to and understand. It seems like we're almost able to track down like the architect of racial segregation.
Yeah. And
right?
Well, what was great is I found this wonderful graduate student you mentioned, mm-hmm. Paige Glotzer, and she's been doing her dissertation research in this archive. And this archive is massive. There's 300 boxes, thousands and thousands of documents, 3,000 photos, 30,000 architectural renderings. And what Paige has done is she's gone in and she's pulled out and found these primary source materials mm-hmm. that tell a really alarming story about the way developers at the Roland Park Company very specifically created covenants, contracts that said if you're black, you can't buy property in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, I want to hone in on that because I think that's very important. Because a lot of times when we talk about institutional racism, you know, sort of a catchphrase, and people don't really know what that means. But I think, you know, segregation had, there were three R's that were part of segregation. There was racial zoning, redlining, and also restrictive covenants, right? So these three R's were the policy tools by which, you know, segregation was implemented. And just the year before these restrictive covenants came out in Roland Park, here in Baltimore, the mayor, J. Barry Mahool, passed the first racial zoning law in the country, and it became the model for racial zoning laws around the country until they were struck down in 1917 in Buchanan versus Worley by the United States Supreme Court. But just a year later, after 1911, which was 104 years ago, just a year later, our good friend at the Roland Park Company, Edward Boughton, I understand, actually enforced or began to sort of solidify restrictive covenants. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So Edward Boughton was the general manager of the Roland Park Company. He wasn't from Baltimore. He was actually from Kansas City.
Right. Yes.
And he was brought in to help develop this what was then several hundred acres of just bucolic land
right.
into what is now Roland Park.
And it was a part of the county at the time,
right? It was
right?
a part of the county.
In 1893, it was still a part of the county, not
yep.
the city.
It wasn't until 1918 that Roland Park and Homeland and Guilford, which
right.
they also developed, became a part of the city. And so as early as the late 1800s, mm-hmm. what we find in this archive mm-hmm. are letters that Boughton wrote to his lawyers, mm. basically saying, hey, I've got this development and I don't want black people to live here.
Right.
Can I legally create a document that says they're not allowed to come?
Right. And go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. And his lawyers replied. And it was interesting because this was 1893. And the lawyers were even a little
yeah.
vexed because
yeah.
they're like, wow, this is novel
yeah.
to try and say that you're going to
yeah.
make it illegal for, you know, a large portion of the Maryland population to
right.
purchase homes in your
An entire race.
And they basically said, we don't really think you should do this.
Now, that was 1893, right?
1893.
We know Plessy versus Ferguson didn't pass until 1896,
mm-hmm.
which sort of enshrined separate but equal,
yep.
right? So Boughton was ahead of the curve, it seems like.
He was, sadly. You know, in some ways, this is, you know, Baltimore was really ahead of the curve
yes.
in a lot of ways here. And basically, Boughton was told by his lawyers at the time, look, you shouldn't put this into the contract. But when they went on and started doing their other developments, Guilford and Homeland,
mm-hmm.
by the time Guilford comes around in 1913, the covenants do have language
mm-hmm.
under a separate title called nuisances.
Right.
And under the nuisances clause,
mm-hmm.
where they're saying you can't do things like keep livestock or make candles
mm-hmm.
or do these things on your residential property, it also basically says at no time, and I'm quoting here,
yes.
at no time shall the land included in said tract or any part thereof or any building erected thereon be occupied by any Negro or person of Negro extraction. This prohibition, however, is not intended to include occupancy by a Negro domestic servant. In other words, if you were black, you could work in these neighborhoods, but you just couldn't live there.
Now, that's a damning quote. That is a very, I mean, you see it in black and white. I'm sure when Paige saw it, I'm sure she leapt out of her seat. I mean, you rarely see like racial discrimination so clearly written and outlined as it is in that quote. I highlighted that same one myself. I have a theory, though, and listeners, I want you to call us again at 410-319-8888. Email us your thoughts at talk@steinershow.org, tweet at Mark Steiner, and comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page. You can reach me at BMoreDOC on Twitter as well. I have a theory, though, Elizabeth, that Edward Boughton had been trying to do this for quite some time, starting in 1893. He sees Plessy versus Ferguson. That's a good sign for segregation. But when he saw in 1911 Baltimore passed this racial zoning law, and then you see the very next year that the very quote that you read outlines that no person of Negro extraction could live in this area, Roland Park, Guilford, and Homeland. I wonder if he saw that the tide had turned enough so that this could actually be really instilled into policy and into contracts. And so then you have like these racially restrictive covenants after 1912.
Well, absolutely. And what's fascinating about this archive and mm-hmm. the work that some of the researchers like Glotzer are doing is
mm-hmm.
it does show how obviously this didn't happen in isolation. This wasn't just Roland Park, Guilford, and Homeland in Baltimore. Boughton was a part of a national dialogue for the emerging professions of real estate.
Right.
So you start to see, you know, real estate associations start
right.
to become solidified.
Right.
And you start to see this group called the high-end developers.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually in 1914, there was this annual conference of the development of high-class property.
High class. Oh,
and
not,
they had
not low class, but high
not
class.
Not low class, high
right.
class, right?
Uh-huh.
And so here are these, you know, developers around the country
mm-hmm.
who are getting together at a national level to compare notes.
Mm.
And basically what they were doing is they were tethering property values to race and also to religion, because let's not forget that Jews were not invited.
I was going to mention that, yes.
To live in these neighborhoods either.
But you wrote in your article that whiteness was basically fungible, or, you know, you couldn't it wasn't as strict as blackness was, right? Like, but Jews were included in this mix of discrimination, right?
Yeah, so basically, you know, there was a depression in 1893 in Baltimore around the time that Boughton was trying to sell property. So he did sell a few tracts to some Jewish families. But on the whole, the belief was that Jews devalued property value. And so, you know, at this high-class property conference, they actually passed out a survey to all the developers about, you know, well, how do you keep Jewish people out of your community? How do you keep blacks out? And they were comparing notes. And if this were happening in isolation, that's one thing, right, this private bigotry. But what you see is how this is informing federal housing policy.
Yes, yes.
So the Federal Housing Administration, when it's founded in the 1930s, their underwriting policy manuals start to say that you need to look at these restrictive covenants.
Right.
You need to keep these in mind when you're thinking about how you're going to finance and fund housing.
As a matter of fact, doesn't one person from the Roland Park Company go and work for
Absolutely.
the Federal Housing Administration?
You start to see how people like Boughton and others really influenced this national dialogue. Mm. And even though, you know, even though these covenants were struck down in 1948 in a Supreme Court.
Shelley versus Kramer.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't mean that the sentiments don't go away.
Right,
you see the ripple effect. You guys talked earlier today in the show about the ripple effect of slavery.
Yes.
You see the ripple effect. So organizations like the Brookings Institution look at housing prices in black neighborhoods versus white neighborhoods.
Right.
And a report that they put out in the early 2000s shows if it's more than 10% black, that neighborhood's housing value is less.
Right. And then, like you said earlier, you know, housing values were explicitly attached to race, such that if you place the same house in a black neighborhood, in a white neighborhood, and it was a fairly nice home, the value would be much higher.
Absolutely.
In a white neighborhood than it was in a black neighborhood, simply because in a black neighborhood, blackness is given a negative value as it relates to property.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm in public health, and so I also saw that their public health was being used as a justification or as a pretext for these restrictive covenants. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So, I mean, what, again, is interesting in this archive is the Roland Park Company kept everything. Mm. They didn't throw anything out.
Right.
So what that means is that you have all their advertisements.
Mm.
You have all of their memos. You have everything that talks about how they were looking to market and sell their properties. And what they were doing, particularly back in the 1890s and even moving into the early 1900s, is they were trying to sort of say that the best place to live was in a segregated, homogenous community that was bucolic and healthy and away from the grime and the dirt of the city, the bad air.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these really explicit advertisements saying, you know, you need to escape what is this dirty and vile urban environment and come to the place where you can have a family in this beautiful setting.
Right.
So they were really
sort of a back to nature sort of angle as well, right?
Absolutely. This was around the City Beautiful movement. It was this idea of what is known as the Arcadian myth, this idea that you want to have this lovely landscaped tree, fresh air, and you want to get out of the city. Of course, the irony being a lot of the people who populated these neighborhoods made their living in the city.
Right.
So you're starting to see sort of the precursor of that suburban model of live outside, travel into work, travel back. And at the time of Roland Park, we had just had the trolley system was coming into play. So that was a big part of how Boughton sold it. You know, get out of the city, use the trolley, come to this beautiful sylvan setting and escape the dirty air of the city.
Absolutely. I mean, really fascinating. I mean, how Baltimore, Maryland, is the origin, the genesis, right, of both racial zoning, and you see a lot of that in, of course, Antero Patella's book, Not in My Neighborhood, but in your article and I think in Glaucer's work, her dissertation. Has she finished it, by the way?
She is still working on it.
Woo!
Yeah, I know.
Hurry up and finish it. I can't wait to see it. But, you know, in this article and her work, you see that Baltimore is really the pioneer, and Boughton is the chief architect, it seems, for racially restrictive covenants. And this is really fascinating history.
Yeah, and you start to see that there are these letters, this correspondence. You know, Glaucer found one from the head then of the Columbia University Planning Department in the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. He writes and says, wow, Roland Park, this is a model. How do we make this a model? And You know, he. This
so he's corresponding with other academics, other professionals in real estate, urban planners.
Absolutely. They're reaching out to Boughton saying, mm-hmm. how did you do Roland Park? Tell us how you did this. And what you're seeing that's interesting is that some of these folks that he's corresponding with, this one letter Glotzer found was from George Board at Ford, and he went on to become New York City's first zoning code author.
Oh.
He went on to be the president of the National Conference on Cities.
Right.
So you start to see how, again, the taproots of this emerging philosophy starts to get out there mm-hmm. into the world and how it evolves into national policy.
Yeah, such as redlining, right? Because you go from racial zoning struck down in 1917 by the Supreme Court. Then you go to restrictive covenants struck down by the Supreme Court in 1948, Shelley versus Kramer. But redlining lasts until 1968,
yep.
right? And as you mentioned earlier, those some of those folks ended up first at the Homeowners Loan Corporation in 1933 under FDR, and then the Federal Housing Administration, which 98% of the loans that it insured were to whites and not other people of color. So, you know, what are the long-lasting sort of implications, you think, of what Boughton and his colleagues and the Roland Park Company started in 1893?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've already mentioned the fact that you can still see it today in real estate housing values, mm-hmm. right? Like, housing values on average are 18% less in black neighborhoods than in white neighborhoods. Interestingly, when I published this story in the fall of 2014, another piece came out by a guy named Richard Rothstein. He's mm-hmm. with the Economic Policy Institute. And you have to remember, this is in the months following Ferguson, right? Michael Brown and everything that was going on there. And Rothstein basically argues that long before the shooting of Michael Brown, official racial isolation policies primed Ferguson for what happened. That effectively, it's an interconnected web. You can't separate out the bigotry and the development that happened in the city from the implications of what happened in the U.S. and in the metropolitan segregation of places like St. Louis and nationwide.
Absolutely. Elizabeth, thank you so much. We really should spend more time talking about this, and I hope we bring you back to this show in the very near future.
Absolutely. I had a great time. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Absolutely. And you're here with the Mark Steiner Show, and I'm your guest host for the day, Lawrence Brown.